Welcome now to our 7 o'clock study on Friday evening here at the Arkansas Camp 1918. And this brings us to number 24 in our series on the Book of Daniel. We're now well into the 11th chapter, coming down toward the end of the Book of Daniel, and hopefully we'll get this book finished before we finish the camping tomorrow. Now, I'd like to come back to the daily for a moment, because it's just possible that some folk gained a slightly wrong impression from my remarks this morning. We did concentrate a good deal upon describing the burnt offering, the meal offering, and the peace offering, which, of course, talk about what man must do to come and lay hold upon the blessings offered in the daily. And this kind of gave some of the impression we're talking about man's sacrifice rather than the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. The daily, of course, is a two-way affair, the outreach of mankind and the outpouring of Jesus Christ. And the daily is a flowing forth every single day from the sanctuary above of the blessings of forgiveness, the blessings of bring growth and sanctification, the blessings of Christ being our plan maker, our guide, and all those various elements in the work of Jesus Christ on our behalf. So the daily is in reality a two-way affair. It is the outreach on the part of the human being every day, and in turn, of course, it is the outflow of love and power from our wonderful high priest in the sanctuary above. Turn back now to Daniel chapter 11, and we have now a number of verses from verse 32 down to verse 39, which speak about the experiences of God's people during the Dark Ages, and also of the activities of the papal church during the same period. And we intend to concentrate mainly on verses 40 to 45, so we'll pass over these verses without going into them in their fullest possible depth, because once again, of course, it deals with the role of our Babylon, which is now passed into history. Verse 32 and on to verse 39. And such as do wickedly shall, against the covenant, shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. We're aware, of course, that Satan's major deception, or major strategy or tactic, is to use deception to win the world to his power. And so flattery, of course, is a form of deception, and Satan uses very extensively through the papal system. But they that know their God shall be strong and do exploits. We are reminded here of the fantastic achievements under the tremendous pressure of folk like the Waldenses, the Vaudois, the Albigenses, and so forth, then later great men like Wycliffe and the early English reformers, followed by the Bohemian reformers Huss and Jerome, and the Martin Luther team, including Luther, Kallstadt, Melanchthon, and many others. And these men, rising out of times of great darkness and degradation, certainly changed the entire course of history and brought about a new order of events in the world in which we live. They actually initiated the final breakdown of Rome's power, and while they themselves did not finish the work, they made a very mighty contribution in that by 1798, they had so, or God through them, had so broken the power of the papacy that she no longer has the power to make God's people captive, take away the daily, or to remove the sanctuary from us. Verse 33, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. And when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. There never has been so savage and prolonged a period of persecution as we find in the Dark Ages. When we read about Babylon of the Old Testament, we don't even read about them being very much of a persecutor. The Babylonians came against Jerusalem, they took the people captive, they brought them back to the land of Babylon, and apparently let them more or less live their own lives as Jewish people in that country. Certainly Daniel and his three friends were allowed to live without any persecution whatsoever, excepting, of course, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were confronted by the burning fiery furnace, and Daniel with the lion's den. But apart from that, there is no evidence of a long, prolonged, and bitter persecution, such as we find down to the Dark Ages. Pagan Rome, of course, was a very savage persecutor. When the mighty power of Christianity began to move out among the various Roman provinces in the days of Paul and the contemporary folk of that time, we find that the Roman emperors became very, very relentless in putting Christians to death. And their favorite method, of course, was to throw the lions as a spectacle in the arena in Rome. And somehow the Romans found great delight in watching lions eat people. They must have had a very strange sense of humor back in those days. Passing on now to verses 36 to 39, we read some statements which I don't fully understand myself in regard to the Roman Catholic power. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. And in short, of course, that describes the activities of the great papal power and the character of the great papal power down to the Dark Ages period, from that point when they had intelligence of those who forsake the Holy Covenant until the time of the end. Now, when does the time of the end begin? No, 1798 is when the time of the end begins, and this is proved very conclusively in Daniel chapter 12. For the moment, I'm going to ask you to simply accept that date, and when we get to Daniel chapter 12, we'll then verify it. There's also a good statement in Great Controversy, which we'll read later, which also verifies the fact that in 1798, the time of the end began. Well, perhaps we'll read it now. It's on page 356 of the book Great Controversy. That'll settle the question for the moment, and then later we can develop from Daniel 12 more definite evidence in this respect. Great Controversy, page 356. The Apostle Paul warned the church not to look for the coming of Christ in his day. That they shall not come, he said, except they come a falling away first, and that men of sin be revealed. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3. Not till after the great apostasy and the long period of the reign of the man of sin can we look for the advent of our Lord. The man of sin, which is also styled the mystery of iniquity, the son of perdition, and as wicked represents the papacy, which, as foretold in prophecy, was to maintain its supremacy for 1260 years. This period ended in 1798. The coming of Christ could not take place before that time. Paul covers with his caution the whole of the Christian dispensation down to the year 1798. It is this side of that time that the message of Christ's second coming is to be proclaimed. Now, going back then to the previous paragraph, the last four or five lines now read as follows. This is especially true of the book of Daniel. But that part of his prophecy which related to the last days, Daniel was bidden to close up and seal to the time of the end. Not till we reach this time could a message concerning the judgment be proclaimed based on a fulfillment of these prophecies. But at the time of the end, says the prophet, many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall be increased. We put those two paragraphs together, we find that the time of the end ends in 1798. The next paragraph further confirms that by saying, but since 1798, the book of Daniel has been unsealed, knowledge of the prophecies has increased, and many have proclaimed the solemn message of the judgment near. Very good. Now, what does Sister White say here? That not till the time of the end came could the book of Daniel be understood. And then she says, since 1798, the book of Daniel has been unsealed, Put those two facts together, and what do we learn about 1798 being the time, right, the beginning of the time of the end? Now then, now comes to us the most important part of Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 to verse 45. These are those verses which deal with the experience or what shall befall God's people in the latter days. Verse 40, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall overflow and pass, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. We now have before us the king of the south and the king of the north and the time of the end. Well, we've solved one problem already, because we know that in 1798 we come to the time of the end, 1798. And now comes the question, who is the king of the north in 1798, and who is the king of the south in 1798? At this point, we must discuss for a moment the two alternative methods of interpreting Bible prophecy. It does require interpretation, because symbolic language is so often used. Very often, we find geographical terms are being used. Terms such as the king of the north, the king of the south, Babylon, Egypt, Israel, the glorious lands, and so forth. And we have to be able to rightly identify in these last days just what those expressions mean. Now, as I said a moment ago, there are two methods which we can follow, and the most popular one, the one that you'll hear any old time when Protestant expositors are telling us what prophecy means, is what we shall here call geographical. In other words, who you are is determined by where you are. And when I put it that way, of course, you begin to suspect the geographical method right away, because where you are does not make you to be what you are. If it did, then to be saved, all I'd have to do is to join the right church. What kind of behavior or character I had wouldn't matter. I'd be saved because I'd be a Christian simply because of where I was. And you know, of course, that where you are does not change you in the least. Well, it may change you a little bit because of environmental circumstances, but you know that while you're sitting here in Arkansas, some of you many hundreds of miles away from your home location, because folk have come from states to the south, to the north, to the west, and to the east, and some of you have travelled great distances to be here, and you know that when you're here, you're still you. And when you go back home again, who are you? You're still you. The geographical change has not made a difference to your character. Now, the other method of interpretation, I shall call, I think, for one of the, as being probably the best of several terms we could use, is the gospel method. In the gospel method, it's not where you are that makes you who you are, but it's what you are that determines that simple factor. In other words, you are either a Babylonian, or you are an Egyptian, or you are an Israelite, and there's no other possibility as far as the Bible is concerned. Or you may say, well, I'm an American, or I'm an Australian, or this other fellow over here is an Englishman, or an African, or an Indian, or a Persian, or an Iranian, or whatever else you might like to name. Now, it's true, of course, that there are many physical nationalities in the world, but we're concerned now with the Bible terminology, and in the Bible there are only three nationalities: Babylonian, Egyptian, and Israelitish. Now, to confirm the fact that the gospel method of interpretation is the correct one, we only have to recognize just what the book of Revelation, and therefore the book of Daniel, is, because Revelation, remember, is the unfolding of the book of Daniel. So therefore, whatever the unfolding is, the thing unfolded must also be. Let's turn then to Revelation, the first chapter, verse 1. You'll notice, of course, the title of the book as given by the translators, not in the original by any means, is The Revelation of St. John the Divine. If they had put instead the revelation through St. John the Divine, Well, yesterday John would do us best, of course, by putting the saint before it, between the revelation of John the Beloved, the revelation through John the Beloved, but the real title of the book is found in verse 1, which says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, God, of course, being the source, to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. In Counsels to Writers, page 175. Do you have the book, Edwin Chance? No. That's an unusual one. It's very few people actually have it. But in that book, page 175, I don't have a copy here, Sister White says, we are to study the gospel that was given to John on the Isle of Patmos, that gospel, the gospel which is entitled The Revelation of Jesus Christ. So what then is the book of Revelation? It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is not, as many people imagine, a recital of the rise and fall of great political powers. It is not, as some people imagine, simply the story of the rise and final fall of Babylon. It is the presentation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, if the revelation, being as it is the unfolding of Daniel, is the gospel of Jesus Christ, then what must Daniel also be? Absolutely. It is likewise the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the gospel principle is, as we've learned so thoroughly over the years, it is not where you are, but what you are that makes you who you are. In the geographical method of interpretation, the king of the north must always be to the north of some reference point, and that reference point, of course, is Palestine, the ancient city of Jerusalem. And the king of the south must be to the south of that same reference point, and therefore it must be Egypt, geographically. And those who use this particular method, of course, regard Turkey today as being the king of the north, Egypt as the king of the south, and Israel, of course, as being the land of Palestine. The river Euphrates they regard as being the literal river, although now they kind of get a little bit symbolic and say, well, it means the people living around the river Euphrates. And whatever nation straddles the river Euphrates is to be dried up so that the kings of the east marching westward will have no hindrance in reaching the plains of Israel where they'll fight against the western kings and bring about the final showdown of political power in the world. Now Uriah Smith, I should put it this way. Now those who take up the geographical method of interpretation invariably find themselves forced to use the gospel principle whenever they're identifying Babylon. Now why is this so? And they must do it also with Edom, for that matter. As you know, we have what we call the Persian Gulf coming up here. The great river Euphrates runs up here, and the Tigris, which is south and north of the Euphrates, remember? North. Okay, well, the Euphrates then swings more or less like this, and the Tigris comes in like that, and the two join and run down to the Persian Gulf. Now, the city of Babylon was located somewhere along the river Euphrates. Now, today, what people, what very important and populous people dwell in the ancient city of Babylon? Nobody, right? Nobody. So therefore, if you're going to use a geographical method to identify modern Babylon, you're kind of hard put to it, aren't you? Because there's nothing there that you could call Babylon. You can't call a heap of ruins inhabited by doleful creatures and dragons a great and mighty city of Babylon which will rule the world in the last days, can you? So therefore, the interpreter is forced to look away from that geographical location to other locations in order to find Babylon the Great in these last days of human history. Now you'd think, of course, that they'd wake up and say, well, here we find ourselves using two methods of interpretation, one geographical and the other symbolic, spiritual, or gospel. Now, if there's one thing that we must recognize, of course, it is this, that you cannot use two different methods of interpretation, because God is not inconsistent, God is not capricious, even though some people think he is, but rather God, when God lays down a symbol in the Bible in code language, And all the way through the prophecies, that same thing always represents the same thing. And the same principle applies in every single prophecy which is being presented to us. So if we find that the system of interpretation that we're using cannot be consistently used with every single symbol throughout the prophecies, then there's something wrong with what we're using. Now, very obviously, of course, we cannot use geographical so far as Babylon is concerned. We cannot use geographical so far as Edom, Moab, and the children of Ammon are concerned. So if we can't, if we just simply cannot use it in those areas, then we cannot use it at all. Does that follow? Does that sound logic? Right? We can't use it at all. Now, when we come to the gospel method of interpretation, we find it can be used with great consistency and great clarity through every single reference that contains any kind of geographical inference, such as the king of the north, the king of the south, the kings from the east, Babylon, Egypt, Moab, Ammon, Edom, and so on. Now, Uriah Smith, in his book Daniel the Revelation, makes a statement which goes something like this when he comes to verse 40 in Daniel chapter 11. He says, now here once again after a long time we find the king of the north is once again introduced to us. Who is the king of the north? He says, the only way, now I'm just paraphrasing it because I don't remember the exact words. He says, the only way that we can identify who was the king of the north in 1798 is to ask what power at that time occupied the same geographical territory as the original king of the north. He said, if this is not a correct principle of interpretation, he said, we are left without any principle of interpretation. Very good then. Let's now test Uriah Smith's statement to see how valid it happens to be so far as Bible truth is concerned. And once again, we'll draw ourselves a rough little map of the Mediterranean basin. Here we have, for instance, Asia Minor, once again Palestine, Nile Basin, Northern Africa going across there, Black Sea up here somewhere, Greece. Here we have Italy, and we come down to the Iberian Peninsula, up over France, and so on. You'll recognize it even though it's rather distorted map on the board tonight. Now then, in the early part of Daniel chapter 11, the king of the north was definitely located in what today is the land of Turkey. Israel, of course, was right where it still is, and Egypt was down here where Egypt still is. And over here, of course, we have the two great rivers and Babylon located on the great river Euphrates. Then, originally, of course, a very popular city, but today an utter desolation and wreck. Now, Uriah Smith says that whatever power today occupies a geographical territory occupied by the king of the north, there is still the king of the north. But remember that the angel told Daniel in chapter 10 that he would show him that which was noted in the scripture of truth. And the scripture of truth was not at that time Daniel chapter 11. It wasn't written yet. It wasn't revealed yet. So what was shown to Daniel in chapter 11 had already been written somewhere else in the scripture of truth. That means, of course, we have to go until we find the king of the north in the scriptures of truth which were already written back in the days of in the days of Daniel. We'll find that Daniel's teacher, Jeremiah, is the prophet to whom God had a great deal to say about the king of the north. Let's turn back to Jeremiah, the first chapter, and I'm going to suggest a rather useful exercise for you all. I won't take time today to read every single reference to the king of the north, but over and over and over again throughout the book of Jeremiah, references are made to the king of the north. Jeremiah chapter 1 is a good starting point, and we'll start with verse 13. And the word of the Lord came unto me the second time, saying, what seest thou? And I said, I see a seething pot, and the face thereof is toward the north. My margin said we should read from the north. And the Lord said unto me, out of the north, and evil shall break forth upon all the inhabitants of the land. For lo, I will call all the families of the kingdoms of the north, except the Lord, and they shall come, and they shall set everyone his throne at the entering of the gates of Jerusalem, and against all the walls thereof, round about, and against all the cities of Judah. Now you know very much, well as much as I do, what power was prophesied by those words as being the great and mighty power which had come out of the north and would compass Jerusalem around and eventually bring about her destruction. And what power was it? Babylon. It certainly was not any power of Asia Minor, but it was the mighty kingdom of Babylon. Now some folk may object that Babylon didn't really come from the north, they came from the east. Well, as I'm not concerned about geographical direction, although in fact the Babylonians, to avoid the great Arabian desert, would travel up the Euphrates River, and then they would come down upon Israel from the north. And that gave their armies, of course, a much better route to follow, because they would have water all the way up the Euphrates River, and then they come into the well-watered lands of the northern area of Palestine, and would not have to come across the burning waste of the great Arabian desert where there was no water, and of course excessive dehydration or soldiers marching across those burning sands. So the actual approach to Israel was from the north. However, it is still not what made the king of the north to be the king of the north, as we shall learn as we progress. Now, as I said, if you take the book of Jeremiah and read it through, you'll find that over and over again throughout this book, we have references to the king of the north as being the great enemy which would come down and war against the Israelites, destroy Jerusalem, and take the whole land captive. Let's pass on now to a chapter which I'll have to find here again. I think it's about chapter, 25, that's far back. No, it's not what I was looking for, but it is a reference, of course, that talks about Nebuchadnezzar as coming from the north. Thank you very much. Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and an hissing and perpetual desolation. What I'm looking for is a chapter which talks about the attack of Babylon against Egypt, and in turn of after that, the return of Babylon against the city of Jerusalem. So I find you a chapter off behalf, I've just forgotten apparently at the moment. In this chapter it plainly describes the coming of the king of the north, Babylon, against the land of Egypt first of all, and then in turn the Babylonians would come back and to destroy the Israelites. And in this section it very, very plainly and clearly tells us that Babylon was the king of the north. It is the strongest and best reference of all in the book of Jeremiah to this effect. I thought I had it very clearly in mind, but apparently I've slipped my memory on that particular chapter, and so I don't find it quickly at the moment. In any case, when you read the book of Jeremiah through, which I think would be a very, very good exercise, to have you realize that Jeremiah's ministry was so much a type of the going through at the present time, you find that reference quite clearly and plainly, and be able to recognize the fact that Babylon is called the king of the north. I wonder if I should be in the book of Isaiah, perhaps. Well, let's not lose time at the moment finding it. Isaiah 25. We've already looked at that one. That's not the one I want. Yeah, we read that a moment ago. We read it just a little while ago. I'll find it for the next study period anyway, during the interval, and I'll read it to you then. Now, this means then that before the king of the north was found here in Asia Minor, the king of the north was found over here on the great river Euphrates. Now, let's go still farther back in the history of the king of the north, and this time to Isaiah, the 12th chapter, the 14th chapter, I beg your pardon, and we'll read from verses 12 down to verse 14. Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 14, which talk about the fall of Lucifer from heaven. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the side of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Now, this is before Satan ever even left heaven. And when he planned to take the place of Jesus Christ up in heaven, that involved his sitting in the sides of the north. So therefore, who is the real king of the north? Christ is the real king of the north, the original king of the north. And who is the counterfeit king of the north? That's Satan. Right. Now, when Satan came down to this earth, he then set himself in the eyes of many men in the very position which Christ alone should have occupied. Now, people ask me the question, well, how can we say Satan is the king of the north when he isn't, when he's not really that? We say in the 666 study, of course, that Satan is not the vicar of the Son of God. He professes to be, he pretends to be, he claims to be, but he is not the vicar of the Son of God. Now, at the same time, we say that he is the king of the north. Counterfeit one, of course, and the reason why we can say this is because Satan has taken the place of Christ on this earth, so therefore he's become the prince of this world, and the prince of this world in the place of Jesus Christ, and therefore he has actually taken the place of Christ on this earth, and has become the leader of mankind, and therefore can legally take the title of the king of the north. Whereas he cannot take the title of the vicar of the Son of God, because he's not the vicar of the Son of God, but he is the prince of this world. You see the distinction? And there is a distinction. All right then, now, of course, Babylon has always been the expression of Satan's thinking, Satan's plans, and Satan's tactics. And therefore, whatever title belongs to Satan belongs to himself in this form upon this earth, namely the great and terrible city of Babylon. So therefore, wherever we find the prince of this world operating, or in other words, wherever we find man in the place of God upon this earth, then what have you got, in fact? You've got Babylon, which is the king of the north. Now, when the great city of Babylon fell, as it did, of course, in the days of Cyrus, the king of the Persians, the Medes, the Persians, and Darius, the king of the Medes, then the priests of Babylon fled from the city of Babylon, and they came over and they established a new base at Pergamos. At the same time, they also journeyed over to Rome, right over here, and established another base over there in Rome. Now, what religion do you suppose they established in Pergamos? The same religion. Now, if that religion was called the King of the North in Babylon, what must it be called here in Asia Minor? Babylon still. And what must it be called over here in Rome? Babylon or the King of the North, right? Now, what made this to be the King of the North, where it was or what it was? Right. And what made Babylon to be the King of the North, where it was or what it was? What it was. So then, what we've done now is we've gone back into the scriptures of truth that were the scriptures in existence in the days of Daniel. And in Isaiah and Jeremiah, we have traced the king of the north back beyond Asia Minor to the river Euphrates, and back beyond that to Satan himself, who, having become the actual prince of this world in the place of Adam and therefore the place of Jesus Christ, has in fact become the king of the north because he put himself in the place of Christ as far as Christ's position is concerned. But because he is not the vicar of the Son of God, he is not Christ's representative. Even though he may profess to be that, he is not actually that. He cannot claim to be the vicar of the Son of God. Now then, having identified the king of the north, let's identify the king of the south from the references given to us in Scripture. And now we turn to the book of Revelation, which is the unfolding of Daniel, to find out what power is described as being the king of the north. And this brings us to Revelation, the 11th chapter. Revelation chapter 11, which deals with the beast from the bottomless pit that rose up to make war against the two witnesses, which were slain and were left alive 3 days and a half in the streets of that great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt. Very good then, let's now look at these verses. We start with verse 3 as a good starting place. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. If any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood, and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them, and their dead bodies shall lie in the streets of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. In the Great Controversy, page 269, God, through Sister White, gives to us a very clear revelation of who Egypt was in 1798, that is, at the end of the 1,260 years of papal supremacy, when the two witnesses clothed in sackcloth. And here are the words, and listen carefully. I want you to tell me whether Sister White uses A, geographical method of interpretation, B, spiritual methods, or C, a mixture of both. If you listen very carefully as a class tonight and give me back the answer, if we have time. The great city in whose streets the witnesses are slain and where their dead bodies lie in spiritual Egypt. Of all nations presented in Bible history, Egypt most boldly denied the existence of the living God and resisted his command. No monarch ever ventured upon more open and high-handed rebellion against the authority of heaven than did the king of Egypt. When the message was brought him by Moses in the name of the Lord, Pharaoh proudly answered, "Who is Jehovah, that I should hearken unto his voice to let Israel go? I know not Jehovah, neither will I let, moreover I will not let Israel go." This is atheism. That's those three words. This is atheism. And the nation represented by Egypt would give voice to a similar denial of the claims of the living God and would manifest a like spirit of unbelief and defiance. The great city is also compared spiritually to Sodom. The corruption of Sodom in breaking the law of God was especially manifested in licentiousness. And this sin was also to be a preeminent characteristic of the nation that should fulfill the specification of this prophecy. According to the words of the prophet then, a little before the year 1798, some power of satanic origin and character would rise to make war upon the Bible. And in the land where the testimony of God's two witnesses should thus be silenced, there would be manifest that the atheism of the Pharaoh and the licentiousness of Sodom. This prophecy has received a most exact and striking fulfillment in the history of France. Now my questions: did Sister White use geographical interpretation? Did she use spiritual or gospel? Did she use a mixture of both?
No.
No, she didn't. Very good. In other words, she only asked one question: where do I find the atheism of Egypt and the licentiousness of Sodom? And it was away over here, thousands of miles away from Egypt, in revolutionary France. And where she found that character, there she found the king of the south, or the land of Egypt. And there's no better confirmation anywhere in the Spirit of Prophecy, I don't think, than that paragraph to show us the correct method of interpreting Bible prophecy. Now at this point we'll have to stop.